Aren't you going to say good morning to Inspector Maigret, Jean-Paul? Good morning. Would you go up to your room?
The kitchen was small, but even though it was still early morning, perfectly clean and tidy. Young Gaston picked up his book without protest, went out to the corridor and up the stairs.
Come this way, Inspector.
They went out to the corridor as well and entered the room that served as a parlour, probably never used. There were armchairs and antimacassars of point lace, an upright piano against a wall, a round table of solid oak, photographs on the walls and knick-knacks everywhere.
Please, do sit down.
There were four rooms in the house, all equally small, and Maigret felt both too tall and too big there. He had also felt from the moment he stepped inside the house that he had suddenly entered an unreal world. He had been warned that Madame Gaston was a female version of her husband, but he'd never imagined her to be so like him that they could indeed be taken for brother and sister. Her hair was of the same nondescript colour, also already thinning, while the middle part of her face seemed thrust forwards, and her pale eyes seemed myopic. As for the child, he was a caricature of both his parents. Upstairs, was he trying to listen in, or had he returned to his notebook? He was 12 or 13, and already looked like a little old man, or more precisely, a creature of no particular age.
"I didn't send him to school,"
explained Madame Gaston, closing the parlour door.
"I thought it best. You know how cruel children are."
If Maigret had remained standing, he would almost have filled the room. Sitting quietly in an armchair, he gestured towards the woman to sit down, for it tired him to see her standing there. She looked as ageless as her son. He knew she was only 34, but he had rarely seen a woman abandon all femininity to such an extent. Beneath her dress of an indefinable colour, her body was thin and tired, with a suggestion of two breasts that hung like empty pockets, while her back was beginning to hunch, and her skin, instead of colouring in the country sun, had gone greyish. Even her voice sounded washed out. She tried to smile, though, and timidly touched Maigret's forearm as she told him,
"I'm so grateful to you for having believed in him."
He could not tell her that he was certain of nothing yet, or admit that it was the first spring sunshine in Paris and the memory of oysters with white wine that had suddenly impelled him to come.
"If you knew how I reproach myself, Inspector, because I'm the one responsible for what's happened. I'm the one who spoiled both his life and my son's. I'm doing my best to atone for it. I try so hard, you see."
He felt uncomfortable, as when you unwittingly enter a house where someone you don't know has died and you don't know what to say. Maigret had just walked into another world, one that did not belong to the village pressing in all around it. Those three, Gaston, his wife and their son, belonged to such a different race that the inspector understood the country people's distrust.
"I don't know how it will all turn out," she continued after a sigh, "but I don't want to believe that the courts will condemn an innocent person. He's such an extraordinary man. You've met him, but you don't know him. Tell me, how was he yesterday evening?"
"Fine. Quite calm."
"Is it true that he was handcuffed at the station?"
No, he went with the police officers, of his own accord."
"Were there people who saw him?"
"It was all very discreet."
"Do you think he needs anything? His constitution is delicate. He's never been very strong."
She wasn't crying. She'd probably cried so much in her life that she'd run out of tears. Just above her head, to the right of the window, was the photograph of an almost chubby young woman, and Maigret could not take his eyes off it, wondering if she'd ever really been like that, with laughing eyes and even dimples in her cheeks.
"You're looking at my portrait when I was young."
There was another one of Gaston to make a pair. He had hardly changed at all, except that back then he had worn his hair rather long. Bohemian style had been the phrase, and he had doubtless written poetry as well.
"Did they tell you?"
she murmured after a glance at the door, and he felt that this was what she most wanted to talk about. This was what she'd been thinking about ever since hearing that he was coming. This was the only thing for her that mattered.
"You mean what happened in Courbevoie?"
"Charles. Yes."
She caught herself, blushed, as if this name were taboo.
"Chevasu."
She nodded.
"I still wonder how that could have happened. I've suffered so, Inspector, and I wish someone would explain it to me. You see, I'm not a wicked woman. I met Joseph when I was 15, and I knew right away that he was the one I would marry. We planned our life together. Together we decided that we would become teachers.
Was he the one who gave you the idea?
I think so. He's more intelligent than I am. He's a man of superior gifts. Because he's too modest, people don't always realize this. We earned our diplomas the same year we got married, and thanks to an influential cousin, we were both sent to Courbevoie.
Do you think that this is connected to what happened here on Tuesday?
She looked at him, startled. He ought not to have interrupted her because she'd lost her train of thought. It's all my fault.
She frowned, anxious to explain herself.
Without what happened in Courbevoie, we wouldn't have come here. There, people thought highly of Joseph. They have more modern ideas, you understand. He was doing well. He had a future.
And you?
It was the same for me. He helped me, advised me. Then, one day, it was as if I'd gone crazy. I still wonder what possessed me. I didn't want to. I struggled against it. I swore to myself that I would never do such a thing. Then, when Charles was there...
She blushed again, stammering, as if she were offending Maigret himself by speaking of the man.
Please excuse me. When he was there, I could not resist. I don't think it was love, since I love Joseph and always have. I was seized by a kind of fever and no longer thought of anything else, not even our son, who was quite young. I would have left him, Inspector. I really thought about leaving them both, going away anywhere. Do you understand that?
He didn't dare tell her that she'd probably never felt sexual pleasure with her husband and that hers was a common story. She needed to believe that her affair was extraordinary, needed to fret, to repent. To call herself the lowest of women. Are you a Catholic, Madame Gaster? That was another sensitive point.
I was like my parents before I met Joseph. He believes only in science and progress. He hates priests.
You stopped practicing your faith?
Yes.
Since that happened, you haven't returned to the church?
I couldn't. I feel it would be betraying him again. Anyway, what would be the point? The first years here... I hoped we would begin a new life. People watched us warily, as always in the countryside. Still, I was convinced that one day they would notice my husband's fine qualities. Then, I don't know how, they found out what happened in Courbevoie, and even the pupils stopped showing him any respect. When I tell you that it's all my fault...
Did your husband have any arguments with Léonie Bira?
On occasion, because he was the village hall secretary. She was a woman who always stirred up trouble. There were questions about some benefits that had to be resolved. Joseph is strict. He feels duty-bound and won't certify something that isn't true.
Did she know what had happened to you?
Like everyone else.
She stuck her tongue out at you, too.
And shouted rude things at me when I walked by her house. I avoided going that way. Not only did she stick out her tongue at me, but sometimes when she saw me at the window, she turned around and pulled up her skirts. Please excuse me. That an old woman would do that seemed almost unbelievable. She was like that. But Joseph would never have thought of killing her for it. He wouldn't have killed anyone. You've seen him. He's a gentleman who would like the whole world to be happy.
Tell me about your son.
What do you want me to say? He's like his father. He's a quiet boy, studious, very advanced for his age. If he isn't top of his class, it's because people would accuse my husband of favouring his son. Joseph gives him grades lower than he deserves on purpose.
The boy doesn't rebel.
Oh, he understands. We've explained to him why we must do it.
Does he know about the business in Courbevoie?
We've never spoken to him about it. But his classmates wouldn't pass up a chance like that. He pretends not to know anything.
Does he ever play with the others?
In the beginning, yes. For 2 years now, since the village has come out openly against us, he prefers to stay at home. He reads a lot. I'm giving him piano lessons. He already plays quite well for his age.
The window was closed and Maigret was beginning to feel stifled, wondering if he hadn't suddenly been trapped in some old photo album.
Your husband came over here on Tuesday morning, shortly after 10.
Yes, I think so. They've asked me that question so many times, in every possible way... as if they wanted at all costs to get me to contradict myself that I'm no longer sure of anything. Usually, during playtime, He comes to the kitchen for a moment and pours himself a cup of coffee. I'm almost always upstairs at that time.
He doesn't drink wine?
Never. He doesn't smoke either.
On Tuesday, did he come in during playtime?
He says no. I said no too, because he never lies. Then they claim that he did come in later.
You denied this?
I was speaking in good faith, Monsieur Maigret. A while later, I remembered having found his empty coffee bowl on the kitchen table. I don't know whether he came in during playtime or afterwards.
Could he have gone to the tool shed without you seeing him?
The room where I was, upstairs, has no window on the garden side.
Could you see Léonie Birard's house?
If I'd looked, yes.
Didn't you hear the shot?
I didn't hear anything. The window was closed. I've become very sensitive to the cold. I've always had that tendency. And during playtimes I close the windows even in the summer because of the noise.
You told me that the people here don't like your husband. I'd like to clarify this point. Is there anyone in the village particularly dislikes your husband?
Certainly. The deputy mayor.
Théo.
Théo Kumar, yes, who lives right behind us. Our gardens are next to each other. Every morning he starts drinking white wine in his storeroom, where he always has a barrel on tap. After 10 or 11, he's at Louis's place, and he keeps drinking into the evening.
Doesn't he do anything?
His parents owned a large farm. Him, he's never worked in his life. One afternoon, when Joseph was in La Rochelle with Jean-Paul last winter, Théo came into the house at around 4:30. I was upstairs changing. I heard heavy footsteps on the stairs. It was Théo. He was drunk. He pushed open the bedroom door and started to laugh. Then right away, as if he were in a brothel, he tried to push me back onto the bed. I clawed him in the face, leaving a long scratch on his nose. It bled. He began cursing, shouting that a woman like me had no right to play hard to get. I opened the window, threatening to call for help. I was in my slip. In the end, he went away, mostly, I think, because of the blood running down his face. Since then, he's never spoken to me. He's the one who controls the village. The mayor, Monsieur Ratto, is a mussel farmer who has no time to spare from his business and only shows up at the village hall on council days. Théo runs the elections as he likes, does favours, always ready to sign any old paper.
Do you happen to know if he was in his garden on Tuesday morning, as he claims?
If he says so, it's probably true, because others must have seen him. Although, if he asked them to lie in his favour, it's true that they wouldn't hesitate to do so.
Would it bother you if I had a little chat with your son? She rose, resigned, and opened the door.
Jean-Paul, will you come down?
Why?
Said the voice upstairs.
Inspector Maigret would like a word with you.
Hesitant footsteps were heard. The boy appeared, a book in his hand, staying mistrustfully in the doorway at first. Come in, my boy. I assume you're not afraid of me.
I'm not afraid of anyone.
He spoke in almost the same muffled voice as his mother. Were you in school on Tuesday morning? Jean-Paul looked at the inspector, then at his mother, as if wondering if he ought to answer even such an innocent question.
You may speak, Jean-Paul. The inspector's on our side.
Her look seemed to apologize to Maigret for that affirmation. Even then, the child simply answered with a nod. What happened after playtime? Still the same silence. Maigret was becoming a monument of patience. I assume you want your father to get out of prison, and the real culprit to be arrested? The thick lenses of a boy's glasses made it hard to judge the look in his eyes. He didn't turn away, on the contrary. He stared his questioner full in the face, without a flicker of movement in his thin features.
For the moment, continued the inspector, I know only what these people say. A small fact, seemingly unimportant, can put me on the track of something. How many pupils are there at the school?
Answer, Jean-Paul. 32 in all,
he replied grudgingly. What do you mean by in all?
The older and the younger ones. Everyone on the register. There are always absentees, explained his mother. Sometimes, especially in the spring, there are only 15 or so, and we can't always send gendarmes to see the parents.
Do you have any chums?
No,
he said curtly. There isn't a single one among the village children who's your friend.
At that, seeming to defy the inspector, he announced,
I'm the teacher's son.
Is that why they don't like you?
He didn't reply.
What do you do during playtime?
Nothing.
You don't come to see your mother?
No.
Why?
Because my father doesn't want that.
Madame Gaston explained again.
He doesn't want to make any distinction between his son and the others. If Jean-Paul came here during the playtimes, there would be no reason why the village officer's son, or the butcher's, for example, couldn't cross the road to go home.
I understand. Do you remember what your father did on Tuesday, during playtime?
No.
Doesn't he monitor the children?
Yes.
He stands in the middle of the courtyard?
Sometimes.
He didn't come to this house?
I don't know.
Maigret had rarely questioned anyone so recalcitrant. If he had had an adult in front of him, he would probably have lost his temper. And, sensing that, Madame Gaston stayed near her son to protect him, placing a hand on his shoulder in a conciliatory gesture.
Answer the inspector politely, Jean-Paul. I'm not being rude.
At 10 o'clock, you all return to the classroom. Did your father go to the blackboard?
Through the curtains at the window, he saw a section of that blackboard with words written in chalk in the building across the way.
Perhaps.
It was a class in what subject?
Grammar.
Did anyone knock at the door?
Perhaps.
You're not sure. Didn't you see your father leave?
I don't know.
Listen to me. When the teacher leaves the class, the pupils usually start getting up, talking, clowning around. Jean-Paul kept quiet. What happened on Tuesday?
I don't remember.
You didn't leave the classroom.
Why?
You might, for example, have gone to the toilet. I see that it's in the courtyard.
I didn't go there.
Who went over to the windows?
I don't know.
Now Maigret was on his feet, and in his pockets, his fists were clenched.
Listen to me.
I don't know anything. I didn't see anything. I have nothing to tell you.
Suddenly the boy left the room and went upstairs, where they heard him close a door.
You mustn't be angry at him, Inspector. Put yourself in his place.
Yesterday the lieutenant questioned him for an hour, and when my son came home, he didn't say a single word to me, but went to lie down on his bed where he stayed until it was dark, with his eyes wide open.
Does he love his father?
She didn't understand the precise point of the question.
What I mean is, does he have a special affection or admiration for his father, or else, for example, does he prefer you? Does he confide in you, or in him?
He confides in no one. He certainly prefers me to his father.
How did he react when they accused your husband?
He was just as you've seen him here.
He didn't cry.
I've not seen him cry since he was a baby.
How long has he had a rifle?
We gave it to him for Christmas.
Does he often use it?
Now and then he goes for a walk alone, like a hunter, with a rifle on his arm. But I don't think he fires it often. He tacked a target to the linden in the courtyard a few times, but my husband explained to him that he was wounding the tree.
I suppose, if he had left the classroom on Tuesday while your husband was gone, that his classmates would have noticed.
Of course.
And they would have mentioned it.
You would actually think that Jean-Paul...
I'm obliged to think of everything. Which student claims to have seen your husband leaving the tool shed?
Marcel Cellier.
Whose son is he?
His father's the village officer, who's a tinsmith, an electrician and a plumber as well. He also occasionally repairs roofs.
How old is Marcel Cellier?
The same age as Jean-Paul, give or take a few months.
He's a good student?
The best, with my son. To avoid seeming to favour Jean-Paul, my husband always gives Marcel the top grade. His father is smart, too, and industrious. I believe that they're good people. Are you very angry with him?
With whom?
Jean-Paul. He was practically rude to you, and I never even offered you anything to drink. Won't you have something?
No, thank you. The lieutenant must have arrived, and I promised to see him.
Will you keep helping us?
Why do you ask me that?
Because if I were you, I think I would be discouraged. You came so far, and what you find here is so uninviting.
I will do my best. Seeing that she was about to take his hand in hers, perhaps to kiss them, he went to the door. He was in a hurry to get outside, to feel the fresh air on his skin, to hear other sounds besides the tired voice of the teacher's wife. I'll be back to see you again, no doubt.
You don't think he needs anything?
If he does, I'll tell you.
Shouldn't he be choosing a lawyer?
That isn't necessary, right now. While he was crossing the courtyard without a backwards look, the double glass doors of the school swung open, and a swarm of children rushed outside, yelling. A few of them stopped short when they spotted him, having probably learned from their parents who he was, and watched him pass. They were of all ages, six-year-old kids and big boys of 14 or 15, who already looked almost like adults. There were girls, too, clustered in a corner of a yard, as if to get away from the boys. At the end of the corridor, where the two doors stood open, Maigret caught sight of a local police car. He knocked at the door of the secretary's office. "Come in," called Danielu. The lieutenant, who had taken off his belt and unbuttoned his tunic, was working at Gaston's desk, with papers spread out before him and municipal stamps all around. He rose to shake hands with Maigret, who did not immediately notice a plump girl sitting off in a dark corner with a baby in her arms. "Take a seat, Detective Chief Inspector. I'll be with you in a moment. I've taken the precaution of calling in all the witnesses a second time and going through the interrogations again. Because of Maigret's arrival in Saint-André, undoubtedly. A cigar?
No, thanks. I smoke only a pipe."
"I'd forgotten." The lieutenant smoked very black cigars, which he chewed on as he talked. "If you don't mind," he said, and turned to the girl, "you say she promised to leave you everything she had, including the house?"
"Yes, she promised it."
"Before witnesses?" The girl didn't seem to know what that meant. In fact, she did not seem to know much at all, and rather seemed like the village idiot. She was a big, stout girl, solid as a man, wearing a cast-off black dress, and there were wisps of hay in her uncombed hair. She smelled bad. The baby did, too, of urine and feces. "When was this promise made?"
"A long time ago."
Her large eyes were of an almost transparent blue, and she frowned in an effort to understand what was wanted of her.
"What do you mean by a long time? A year?"
"Maybe a year."
"2 years?"
"Maybe."
"How long have you been working for Léonie Bira?"
"Wait. After I had my second child. No, the third."
"How old is he?"
Her lips were moving as if she were in church while she did her mental arithmetic.
5.
"Where is he now?"
"At home."
"How many are there at home?"
3. I've the one here, and the oldest is at school."
"Who's taking care of them?"
"No one."
The two men exchanged glances. "So you've been working for Léonie Bira for about 5 years. Did she promise you right away to leave you her money?"
"No."
"After 2, 3 years?
"Yes."
2 or 3?
"I don't know."
"Did she sign a paper?"
"I don't know."
"And you don't know either why she made you that promise?"
"To make her niece mad. She told me so."
"Did her niece used to come to see her?"
"Never."
"She's Madame Cellier, the village officer's wife, isn't she?"
"Yes."
"The officer never came to see her either?"
"Yes, he did."
"They weren't angry with each other?"
"Yes, they were."
"Why did he come to see her?"
"To threaten to report her for throwing filth out of the window."
"Did they argue?"
"They screamed insults at each other."
"Did you feel affection for your employer?" She looked at him with her round eyes, as if the idea that she could be fond or not of someone had never occurred to her.
"I don't know."
"Was she nice to you?"
"She gave me leftovers."
"Of what?"
"Food. And also her old dresses."
"Did she pay you regularly?"
"Not much."
"What do you mean by not much?"
"Half what the other women pay me when I work for them. But she had me in every afternoon, so..."
"Have you seen her arguing with other people?"
"With almost everyone."
At her house?
She never left home anymore. She shouted things out the window at people.
What things?
Things that they'd done, and they didn't want others to know.
So everyone hated her?
I think so.
Did someone hate her in particular, enough to want to kill her?
Of course, since somebody did.
But you haven't the slightest idea who could have done that.
I thought you knew.
Pardon?
Because you arrested the teacher.
You think he's the one?
I don't know.
A question, if I may, said Maygray quickly, turning to the lieutenant.
Be my guest.
Teo, the deputy mayor, is he the father of one or more of your children?
She did not seem offended, and appeared to be thinking.
Maybe so. I'm not sure.
Did he get along well with Leonie Bira?
She thought some more.
Like the others.
Did he know that she'd promised to put you in her will?
I told him so.
How did he react? She did not understand the word. Well, how did he answer you?
He told me to demand a paper from her.
Did you do that?
Yes.
When?
A long time ago.
She refused.
She said that everything was arranged.
When you found her dead, what did you do?
I shouted.
Right away?
As soon as I saw the blood. At first I thought she'd fainted.
Did you look through the drawers?
What drawers?
Maygray signalled to the lieutenant that he had finished. Danielo stood up.
Thank you, Maria. If I need you again, I'll send for you.
She didn't sign any paper?
Asked the girl, standing near the door with her baby.
We haven't found anything yet.
Then she grumbled, turning away from them.
I should have known she was cheating me.
They saw her pass by the window, looking unhappy, and talking to herself. Chapter 4 The Postmistress's Letters. The lieutenant sighed, as if in apology.
You see, I do what I can.
And it was certainly true. He was even more conscientious now that there was a witness to his investigation, someone from the famous police judiciaire, and thus particularly impressive in his eyes. His was a curious story. His family was well known in Toulouse. At the urging of his parents, he'd attended the École Polytechnique, and done more than honourably there. Then, instead of choosing between the army and industry, he had opted for gendarmerie, as well as 2 years of law school. He had a pretty wife, also of good family, and everyone agreed they formed one of the most charming couples in La Rochelle. He was making an effort to seem at ease in the greyish setting of the village hall, into which the sunlight was not yet shining, and which the brightness outside made look almost dark.
It isn't easy to find out what they think, he remarked, lighting a new cigar.
In a corner of the room, 6.22 rifles were leaning against the wall, four of them exactly alike, and one of an old model with a carved stock.
I think I have them all. If there are more somewhere, my men will find them this morning.
He picked up what resembled a cardboard pillbox from the mantelpiece and took out a deformed bit of lead.
I've examined it carefully. I once took a course in ballistics, and we have no expert in La Rochelle. It's a lead bullet, what's sometimes called a soft bullet, which flattens when it hits the target, even if it's a pine board. So it's useless to look for the markings found on other bullets, which often allow identification of the weapon used.
Maygray nodded to show he understood.
Are you familiar with .22 rifles? Continued the lieutenant.
More or less. More or less than more, because he could not remember any crime committed in Paris with such a weapon.
They can shoot two sorts of cartridges, short or long. The short ones have a weak range, but the long ones reach their target at more than 150 meters.
About 20 other lead lumps formed a small pile on the veined marble mantelpiece.
Yesterday we did a few experiments with these different rifles. The bullet that struck Leonie Bira is a .22 long, of the same weight as those we fired.
The cartridge case hasn't been found.
My men went over the gardens behind the house with a fine-tooth comb. They'll continue looking this afternoon. It's possible that the shooter picked up the case. What I'm trying to explain to you is that we have very little material evidence.
have all these rifles been used?
Recently enough. It's hard to judge exactly because the boys don't bother cleaning and oiling them after they're fired. The medical report, which I have here, doesn't help us much either, because the doctor's unable to determine, even approximately, at what distance the gun was fired. It could just as well be 50 meters as more than 100.
Maygrey filled his pipe, standing by the window and listening distractedly. Across the way, near the church, he could see a man with bushy black hair shoeing a horse, while a younger man held its hoof.
The examining magistrate and I have considered the various available hypotheses. The first one we thought of, strange as it may seem, is that it was an accident. There's something so unlikely about this crime, there was so little certainty of killing the former postmistress of a .22 caliber bullet, that we wondered if she hadn't been struck by chance. Someone in the gardens, someone could have been shooting at sparrows the way boys do. There have been stranger coincidences, you see what I mean?
Maygrey nodded. The lieutenant had an almost childish desire for his approval, and was touching in his eagerness to perform well.
That's what we call the theory of the pure and simple accident. If Leonie Bira had died at a different time of day, or on holiday, or elsewhere in the village, we would no doubt have stopped there, because that is the most reasonable theory. Except that when the old woman was killed, the children were in school.
All of them.
Just about. Three or four who were absent, one of them a girl, lived rather far away on farms, and were not seen in the village that morning. Another, the butcher's son, has been bedridden for almost a month. We then thought of a second possibility, that of malice aforethought. Someone, no matter which neighbour, feuding with the Bira woman the way almost all of them were, someone, whom she had aggravated once too often, could have shot at her from a distance in a fit of rage to frighten her, or break her windows, without even thinking that she might be killed. I haven't completely rejected this hypothesis yet, because the third one, that of deliberate murder, requires, first of all, a champion marksman. If the bullet had hit the victim anywhere except in her eye, the wound would not have been too serious. And to hit the eye on purpose at a certain distance, one would have to be an exceptional shot. Don't forget that this happened in broad daylight, in this very block of houses, at an hour when most of the women are at home doing their housework. There's a whole warren of yards and gardens. The weather was fine, and most windows were open.
Have you tried to determine where everyone was at around 10:15?
You heard Maria Smelka. The other depositions are about as clear as hers. People are reluctant to talk. When they go into details, these are so confused that they simply complicate matters.
The deputy mayor was in his garden?
So it seems. It depends on whether we go by radio time or church time, because the tower clock is 15 to 20 minutes fast. Someone who was listening to the radio claims to have seen Theo on the road at around 10:15, heading for the Bon Coin. At the Bon Coin, they affirmed that he arrived only after 10:30. As for the butcher's wife, who was hanging out laundry, she says she saw him go into his wine storeroom for a drink, as he regularly does.
Does he own a rifle?
No. Only a double-barreled shotgun for hunting. This shows you just how hard it is to get any valid evidence. The only evidence that holds up is the boy's.
The policeman's son?
Yes.
Why didn't he speak up the first day?
I asked him that. His answer's plausible. You're doubtless aware that his father, Julien Serrier, married the old woman's niece.
And I know that Leonie Bira had announced her intention to disinherit her.
Marcel Cellier thought it would look as if he wanted to put his father out of the running. It was only the following evening that he mentioned it to him, and Julien Cellier brought him to us on Thursday morning. You'll see them. They're nice people. They seem straightforward.
Did Marcel see the teacher leave his tool shed?
That's what he says. The children in the classroom were left on their own. Most of them were acting up. Marcel Cellier, who was a calmer, more serious boy, went over to the window and saw Joseph Gastin come out of the shed.
He didn't see him go inside.
Only leave. At that point, the shot had to have been fired. Yet the teacher continues to deny having gone in the tool shed that morning. Either he's lying or the boy invented the story. But why?
Why, indeed, murmured Maygrey lightly.
He felt like having a glass of wine. It seemed about the right time for one. Playtime was over in the courtyard. Two old women were passing with shopping bags, walking towards the cooperative shop.
"Might I take a look at Leonie Bira's house?"
he asked. "I'll go with you. I have the key." It, too, was on the mantelpiece.
The lieutenant shoved it in his pocket, buttoned his tunic, and put on his cap. The air outside did smell of the sea, although still not enough for Maigret. They both headed for the street corner, and in front of Pommel's place the inspector asked casually, "Shall we?" "You think?" replied the lieutenant, a little disconcerted. He was not the type to drink in a bistro or an inn. The invitation bothered him, and he didn't know how to refuse. "I wonder if that—"
"Just a quick glass of white wine."
Theo was there, sitting in a corner with his long legs stretched out, a half-litre carafe of wine and a glass within reach. The postman, who had an iron hook instead of his left arm, was standing in front of him. Both men fell silent when the other two came inside.
"What can I get you, gentlemen?"
asked Louis from behind his counter, his sleeves rolled up.
"A carafe."
Danielu, ill at ease, was trying to act naturally. Perhaps that's why the deputy mayor was watching them both with twinkling eyes. He was tall and must once have been fat. When he'd lost weight, his skin had collapsed into folds, like a garment now way too big. His gaze reflected the mocking self-assurance of a peasant as well as that of a politician adept at tampering with municipal elections.
"So, what's happening with that scum of a guest now?"
he asked, as if addressing no one in particular, and Maigret, without really knowing why, answered in the same tone.
"He's waiting for someone to come and take his place."
That shocked the lieutenant. As for the postman, his head whipped round.
"You've discovered something?"
"You're the one who knows the area better than anybody," replied Maigret. "You cover all your territory every day."
"And what a day! Before, not too long ago, there were still folks who never got any mail, so to speak. I remember certain farms where I set foot only once a year for the post office calendar. Now, not only does everyone receive a newspaper, which must be home-delivered, but there isn't anyone who doesn't receive benefits of some kind. If you knew what that means in the way of forms."
He repeated, seemingly overwhelmed,
"Forms, forms."
To listen to him, you might have thought that he was the one who filled them out.
"First the military veterans, that I can understand. Then the widow's pensions. Next the welfare payments, the large family supplements, and the benefits for—"
He turned towards the deputy mayor.
"Can you figure it out? I wonder if there's a single person in the entire village who doesn't get something from the government. And I'm sure that some have kids just for the allowances."
His misted glass of wine in hand, Maigret inquired cheerily,
"Do you think the allowances have something to do with Léonie Birard's death?"
"You never know."
It was doubtless an obsession. He must have been receiving a pension as well for his arm. He was paid by the government, and it infuriated him that others also took their turn at the cashier's window. In short, he was jealous.
"Give me a carafe, Louis."
Theo's eyes were still laughing. Maigret was sipping his wine, and this scene was almost like what he'd envisioned for his trip to the seaside. The air was the same color as the white wine, with the same taste. Two hens were pecking at the hard earth out on the square, where they could hardly be finding any worms. Therese, in her kitchen, was peeling onions and occasionally wiping her eyes with the corner of her apron.
"Shall we go?"
Danielu, who had merely wet his lips in his glass, followed him out in relief. "Don't you think those peasants seem to be making fun of us?" he murmured once outside.
"You don't say."
"It's as if it amuses you." Maigret made no reply. He was beginning to find his footing in the village and no longer regretted having left Cadiz au Ferve. This morning he'd not telephoned his wife as he had promised her he would. He had not even noticed the post office. He would have to get to that soon. They passed a haberdasher's shop, behind the front windows of which the inspector spied a woman so old and withered that it was a miracle she didn't break into pieces.
"Who's that?"
"There are two of them, of about the same age. Mademoiselle Thévenin." Two old spinsters had had a shop in his home village, too. It was as if the villages of France were interchangeable. Years had passed. The roads had filled with speedy cars. Buses and vans had replaced carts. There were cinemas more or less everywhere. The radio and many other things had been invented. And yet here Maigret was finding once again the characters of his childhood, frozen in their attitudes as if in a naive painting.
"This is a house."
It was old, and the only one in the street that hadn't been pebble-dashed in years. The lieutenant fitted the big key into the lock of a green-painted door, which he pushed open. And they smelled a sweetish odour, the same that must have reigned in the home of the two old maids next door. An odour found only where elderly people live, confined in close quarters. The first room somewhat resembled the one where Madame Gaston had received him, except that the oaken furniture was less well polished, the armchairs shabbier, and there was an enormous set of brass fire irons. There was also, in a corner, a bed that must have been brought in from another room, and which was still unmade. "The bedrooms are upstairs," explained the lieutenant. "During the last few years, Léonie Birin no longer wanted to use the stairs. She lived on the ground floor, sleeping in this room. Nothing's been touched." Beyond a half-open door was a rather large kitchen, with a stone fireplace, next to which a coal stove had been installed. The whole place was dirty. On the stove, saucepans had left reddish circles. The walls were spattered with grease. The leather armchair in front of the windows must have been the one where the old woman spent most of her days. Maigret understood why she preferred to stay in this room rather than the one in the front. Almost no one used the road, which led to the sea, whereas in the back one could view, as from the teacher's place, the liveliest parts of the houses, courtyards and gardens, including the schoolyard. It was almost intimate. From her armchair, Léonie Birin took part in the daily lives of a dozen households, and if she had good eyes, she could find out what everyone was eating. "I don't need to tell you that the chalk outline shows the spot where she was found. The stain, you see."
"I understand.
She hadn't bled much."
"Where is she now?"
"They took her to the morgue at La Rochelle for the post-mortem. The funeral will be tomorrow morning."
"We still don't know who inherits."
"I've looked everywhere for a will. I telephoned a lawyer in La Rochelle. She'd often spoken to him about drawing up a will, but had never made one in his presence. He has in his keeping some stocks of hers, some bonds, the title deeds to this house, and to another one she owns 2 kilometers from here."
"So that if nothing is found, her niece will inherit."
"That's my impression."
"What does she say about it?"
"She doesn't seem to be counting on it. The Celliers are not badly off. Without being rich, they have a nice little business. You'll see them. I'm not used to reading people the way you are. I find this family frank, honest, and hard-working." Maigret had begun opening and closing drawers, discovering half-rusted kitchen utensils, a jumble of objects. Old buttons, nails, bills, pell-mell with empty bobbins, stockings, hairpins. He returned to the first room where there was an old chest of drawers that was not without value, and began going through those drawers as well.
"Have you examined these papers?"
The lieutenant reddened slightly, as if he'd been caught out or forced to face unpleasant realities. He'd have the same look in Louis' bistro when he had had to take the glass of white wine Maigret was handing to him. "They're letters."
"So I see."
"They date back more than 10 years to the time when she was still the postmistress."
"As far as I can tell, these letters are not addressed to her."
"That's correct. I will add this correspondence to the file, of course. I've spoken about it to the judge. I can't do everything at once." Every letter was still in its envelope, on which different names were written. Évariste Cornu, Augustin Cornu, Jules Marchandon, Célestin Marchandon, Théodore Coumard. Even more, and women's names too, including those of the 2 Thévenard sisters, the ladies of the haberdasher's shop.
"If I understand correctly, when she was postmistress, Léonie Birin did not send all the mail on to its addressees."
He glanced at a few letters. "Dear Mama, this is to tell you that I am well, and that I hope you are the same. I am happy in my new employer's home, except that the grandfather who lives with them coughs all day long and spits on the floor." Another said, "I met Cousin Jules in the street, and he was ashamed when he saw me. He was completely drunk, and I thought for a moment he'd not recognize me." Léonie Birin did not, evidently, open all the letters. She seemed to pay particular attention to certain families, especially the Cornus and Rateaus, of whom there were many in that region. Several envelopes bore the postmark of the Senate, and were signed by a noted politician who had died 2 years earlier. "My dear friend, I acknowledge receipt of your letter concerning the tempest that ravaged your mussel farm and carried off more than 200 posts. I will see to it that the funds earmarked for victims of national disasters—" "I looked into this," explained the lieutenant. "The farms consist of pine posts driven into the sea bottom and bound together by bundles of sticks. That's where they install the clusters of young mussels to fatten them. When a tide is a little strong, it carries away a certain number of posts, which are expensive, as they must be brought from a great distance."
"So, The cunning fellows get them paid for by the government under the guise of a national calamity.
The senator was very popular, observed Danielu, with a wry smile. He never had any difficulty getting re-elected.
You've read all these letters?
I skimmed through them.
They provide no clues.
They explain why the Pinar woman was hated by the entire village. She knew too much about all of them. She must have told them a few home truths. Still, I haven't found anything really serious. Nothing bad enough in any case for someone, especially after 10 years, to decide to eliminate her with a bullet in the head. Most of the people to whom these letters are addressed are dead, and their children don't care what happened in the past.
You're taking these letters away.
I don't have to remove them this evening. I can leave you the key to the house. Don't you want to go upstairs?
Maigret went up for form's sake. The two rooms, full of strange objects and furniture in poor condition, taught him nothing.
Outside, the lieutenant handed him the key, asking,
What are you going to do now?
What time does the school let out?
The morning session ends at 11:30. Certain pupils who don't live too far away go home for lunch. Those from the farms and the seashore bring bread and butter with them to eat at the school. Classes resume at 1:30 and are over at 4.
Maigret pulled his watch from his pocket. It was 11:10.
Are you staying in the village?
I must go and see the examining magistrate who questioned the teacher this morning, but I'll be back sometime this afternoon.
See you later.
Maigret shook his hand. He wanted another glass of white wine before the classes let out. He stayed there a moment, standing in the sun, watching the lieutenant walk away with a light step, as if relieved of a great burden.
Theo was still at Louis's place. There was also in the opposite corner an old man, almost in rags, with the look of a tramp, with a bushy white beard. Pouring his drink with a shaking hand, he glanced at Maigret only briefly, without interest.
"A carafe?" asked Louis.
"Of the same as before. That's the only kind I have. I suppose you'll be eating here. Therese is cooking a rabbit. I know you'll enjoy."
The maid appeared. "Do you like rabbit in white wine, Monsieur Maigret?"
It was just to see him, to glance at him in complicity and gratitude. He had not betrayed her. She was relieved of that, becoming almost pretty.
"Off to your kitchen."
A van pulled up. A man entered in the working clothes of a butcher. Unlike most butchers, he was thin and unwell, with a crooked nose and bad teeth.
"A perno, Louis."
He turned towards Theo, who was smiling in delight.
"Hello, you old pirate."
The deputy mayor simply gestured vaguely with his hand.
"Not too tired? When I think that layabouts like you exist."
He zeroed in on Maigret.
"So it's you, it seems, who's going to ferret out the truth."
"I'm trying."
"Try hard. If you find out anything, you'll deserve a medal."
His drooping moustache was getting wet in his glass.
"How's your son?"
asked Theo from his corner, his legs still stretched out lazily.
"The doctor claims it's time he was walking. That's easy to say. As soon as we get him upright, he falls down. The doctors don't know anything. No more than deputy mayors."
Although he seemed to be joking, there was a bitter edge to his voice.
"Done with your day, are you? I still have to do bourrage."
He ordered a second glass, drank it down in one go, wiped his moustache, and called to Louis,
"Put that on the tab with the rest."
Then to the inspector,
"Our son."
Finally, he bumped into Theo's legs on purpose as he went out.
"So long, scum."
They saw him start his van and swing into a U-turn.
"His father and mother died of tuberculosis," explained Louis. "His sister's in a sanatorium for TB patients. He has a brother locked up as a madman."
"And him?"
"He holds his own as best he can, sells his meat in the surrounding countryside. He tried to establish a butcher shop in La Rochelle and lost all the money."
"Has he children?"
"A son and a daughter.
The two others died at birth. The son was knocked over by a motorbike a month ago and is still in a cast. The girl, who's 7, must be at school. By the time he's finished his round, he'd have downed a good half bottle of Perno."
"You find that funny?"
asked Theo sarcastically.
"Find what funny?" "To talk about all that. I don't badmouth anyone. You want me to talk about your little doings?"
Looking scared, Louis grabbed a full carafe from under his counter and went to place it on the table.
"You know perfectly well there's nothing to tell. People have to make conversation, don't they?"
Deep down,
Theo seemed to be having a ball. His mouth wasn't smiling, but his eyes were glittering strangely. Maigret couldn't help thinking of some sort of old, retired fawn. There he was, planted in the middle of the village like a malicious god who knew everything that happened inside people's heads and homes, enjoying this show put on for him in solitary pleasure. He saw Maigret more as an equal than as an enemy. "You're a very shrewd man," he seemed to say. "You pass for a champion at your game. Paris, you find out everything anyone tries to hide from you. Only I'm a shrewd man, too. And here, I'm the one who knows. Try, play your game, question people, worm their secrets out of them. We'll see if you ever figure anything out." He slept with Maria, who was dirty and unattractive. He had tried to sleep with Madame Gaston, who was no longer any kind of woman. He drank from morning till night without ever getting completely drunk, floating in a world of his own that must have been amusing, because it made him smile. The old Birar woman knew the village's little secrets as well, but they gnawed at her, working on her like a poison she had to draw out one way or another. He watched the villagers, scoffed at them, and when someone needed a convenient certificate to obtain one of those allowances that so enraged the postman, he approved it, certifying the document with one of those municipal stamps he always had in the pocket of his droopy trousers. He didn't take them seriously.
"Another inspector?"
"Not now." Maigret heard children's voices over by the school. The pupils going home for lunch were coming out. He saw a few of them crossing the square. "I'll be back in half an hour."
"The rabbit'll be ready."
"Still no oysters?"
"No oysters."
Hands in his pockets, he headed for the Cellier's shop. A boy had just gone in there before him, winding his way among the buckets, watering cans, sulfate sprayers that cluttered the floor and hung from the ceiling. There were tools everywhere in a dusty light.
"May I help you?"
inquired a woman's voice. He had to peer into the shadows to find a rather young face and the bright patch of a blue-checked apron.
"Is your husband here?"
"Out back in the workshop."
The boy had gone into the kitchen and was washing his hands at the pump.
"If you'd like to come this way, I'll call him."
She knew who he was and didn't seem frightened. In the kitchen, the vital center of the house, she brought forwards a straw-bottomed chair for him and opened a door to the courtyard.
"Julien, someone to see you."
The boy wiped his hands while observing Maigret curiously, and he, too, brought childhood memories back to the inspector. In his class, in all the classes he'd been in, there had always been a boy fatter than the rest, with the same frank and studious appearance and the same clear skin, the same demeanor of a well-brought-up child. His mother was not big, but his father, who appeared a moment later, weighed more than 100 kilos. He was very tall, quite broad, with an almost babyish face and candid eyes. The man wiped his feet on the doormat before entering. 3 places were set at the round table.
"Excuse me,"
he murmured, going to take his turn at the pump. One sensed that there were rituals here, that each person performed certain gestures at certain moments in the day.
"Were you about to sit down and eat?"
It was the woman who answered,
"Not right away. Dinner isn't ready."
"Actually, what I would most like is a brief chat with your son."
The father and mother looked at the boy without showing any surprise or uneasiness.
"Did you hear, Marcel?"
said the father.
"Yes, Papa."
"Answer the inspector's questions."
"Yes, Papa."
Turned towards Maigret directly in front of him, he assumed the attitude of a pupil preparing to reply to his teacher. Chapter 5 Marcel's Lies. Just as Maigret was lighting his pipe, a kind of silent ceremony took place that, more than everything he had seen since the previous evening in Saint-André, conjured up for the inspector the village of his childhood. For an instant, it was even one of his aunts, also in a blue checked apron, her hair up in a chignon, who took Madame Cellier's place. This last had simply looked at her husband, opening her eyes just a little wider, and big Julien had got the message. He went out of the door to the courtyard, where he disappeared for a moment. As for his wife, without waiting for his return, she had opened the sideboard, taken 2 glasses from a set, the one used only for company, and was polishing them with a clean dish towel. When the tinsmith returned, he was holding a corked bottle of wine. He did not say anything. Nothing needed to be said. Someone from far away or from another planet might have thought that those gestures were part of a religious service. They listened to the sound of a cork coming out of a bottleneck, the gurgling of the golden wine in two glasses. A touch intimidated, Julien picked up one of them and checked its colour, then finally said,
"Cheers!"
"Cheers," replied Maigret. After which the man withdrew to a shadowy corner of the room, while his wife went over to the stove. "Tell me, Marcel," began the inspector, returning to the boy who had not budged, "I presume that you've never told a lie." If there was any hesitation, it was brief, accompanied by a swift glance in his mother's direction.
"Yes, I have, monsieur, but I always confessed it,"
he hastened to add. "You mean you went afterwards to confession?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"Immediately afterwards?"
"As quickly as possible, because I wouldn't like to die in a state of sin."
"They mustn't have been important lies, though, were they?"
"Important enough."
"Would you mind much telling me one, as an example?"
"There was the time I tore my trousers climbing a tree. When I came home, I claimed I'd caught them on a nail in Joseph's yard."
"You went to confession that very day?"
"The day afterwards."
"And when did you admit the truth to your parents?"
"Only after a week. Another time I fell into the pond while fishing for frogs. My parents forbid me to play around the pond because I catch cold easily. My clothes are all wet. I told them I'd been pushed while I was crossing the little bridge over the stream."
"Did you wait a week again before telling them the truth?"
"Only 2 days."
"Do you often lie like that?"
"No, monsieur."
"Once every how long, about?" He took the time to reflect, still as if taking an oral exam.
"Not even once a month."
"Do your friends lie more?"
"Not all of them. Some."
"Do they go to confession like you?"
"I don't know. Probably they do."
"Are you friends with the teacher's son?"
"No, monsieur."
"You don't play with him?"
"He doesn't play with anyone."
"Why?"
"Maybe he doesn't like to play. Or else because his father's the teacher. I try to be his friend."
"Don't you like Monsieur Gaston?"
"He isn't fair."
"How is he not fair?"
"He always gives me the best grades, even when it's his son who deserves them. I would like to be the best in the class when I've earned it, but not otherwise."
"Why do you think he does that?"
"I don't know. Maybe because he's afraid."
"Afraid of what?"
The child tried to find an answer. He certainly sensed what he would have liked to say, but realized that it was too complicated, that he wouldn't find the words. He simply repeated, "I don't know."
"Do you remember Tuesday morning, clearly?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"What did you do during playtime?"
"I played with the others."
"What happened shortly after you returned to the classroom?"
"Old man Piedbeuf from Groschen came knocking at the door, and Monsieur Gaston went with him to the village hall after telling us to wait quietly."
"Does that often happen?"
"Yes, monsieur, rather often."
"Do you all wait quietly?"
"Not all of us."
"Do you personally remain quiet?"
"Most of the time."
"When had that happened before?"
"Also on the day before, Monday, during the funeral, someone came to get a paper signed."
"What did you do Tuesday?"
"At first I stayed in my seat."
"Did your classmates start misbehaving?"
"Yes, monsieur, most of them."
"What were they doing, exactly?"
"They were pretending to fight, for laughs, throwing things at one another's heads, erasers, pencils."
"After that?" If he sometimes hesitated before answering, it wasn't from uneasiness, but like someone trying to find the right words.
"I went to the window."
"Which window?"
"The one through which you see the courtyards and kitchen gardens. That's always the one I look out of."
"Why?"
"I don't know. It's the one closest to my bench."
"It wasn't because you just heard a shot that you went to that window?"
"No, monsieur."
"If there had been a shot outside, you would have heard it?"
"Maybe not. The others were making a lot of noise. And at the forge, they were busy shoeing a horse."
"Do you have a .22 rifle?"
"Yes, monsieur. I took it to the village hall yesterday, like the others did. They asked everyone who has a rifle to take it there."
"While the teacher was gone,
You didn't leave the classroom?
No, monsieur.
Maigret was speaking in a calm, encouraging voice. Madame Cellier had discreetly gone to tidy the shop,